This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Priyanka Srinivasan, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, environmental assessments begin on Bougainville's Panguna mine with the aim of reopening the controversial facility.
People are really struggling now to find money to pay for school fees, to pay for medical expenses.
Vanuatu experiments with using blockchain technology to deliver digital money to its citizens.
They will be given an 8-digit PIN code, and it's using blockchain technology. And so basically, it's secure.
And can waves help power Tonga's future? The kingdom will be putting some cutting-edge renewable energy technology to the test.
They have a good advantage because they're fairly low disturbance. They sit under the water, so they're protected from a rougher ocean.
We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, the man who laid the complaint that led to Papua New Guinea's biggest corruption prosecution says he has no regrets, despite having to flee the country to safeguard his family. Back in 2012, the then Solicitor General, Neville Devete, registered his suspicions with the police over payments of state money being made into what was then PNG's biggest law firm, Paul Peraka Lawyers. Late last month, after more than 10 years of investigations, legal battles and controversy, the firm's principal, Paul Peraka, was found guilty of misappropriating the equivalent of $70 million in public funds. Mr. Devete says the amount of money is staggering and he had to act because it belongs to the people of Papua New Guinea.
The burden that I have been carrying for 10 years, actually lifted off my shoulders. I was actually relieved that at least justice was done and justice has been done in accordance with law. This is a really big case and a big letdown for the people of Papua New Guinea. The 162 million odd million kina, and we don't know, maybe there could be more than that, was only channeled from the very core and the very heart of Waigani, from where the coffers are, and channeled only through a few people, denying the people of Papua New Guinea. So it's that burden actually lifted. I mean, my family had to suffer through all this. And because of the intimidation and thuggery we had faced with this particular law firm over a period of time whilst I was in the office, so it kind of when I got that when I received news of the conviction, I a big burden was lifted off my shoulders.
What has been the cost to you and your family since you laid that complaint?
I came down to do my postgraduate studies. On the 26th of January 2013, I arrived in Townsville. And during the first quarter of 2013, that was when Peraka was arrested. I knew what was going to happen, so they soon found out I was the one that laid the initial complaint. So my family was actually, my wife and my three smaller younger children joined me 6 months after I arrived here. So my only two sons were still in high school were being looked after by their aunt in Port Moresby. And that's when intimidation and threats started. They started receiving threats and intimidation and cars arriving at home and asking questions as to where I was and all that.
Looking back now on all that's happened since, not only to your family, but to PNG politics, I mean, the Peraka Gate scandal blew up. It nearly brought down the then Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill. We had the student protests at UPNG. Lots of things stemmed from this. Do you regret making that complaint?
For me personally, I don't regret one bit making and laying that initial complaint. This is money that rightfully belongs to the people of Papua New Guinea. And the way it has been chiffoned out of Papua New Guinea, or the way it was, the people of Papua New Guinea have been denied 162 million, just about 72 million Australian dollars, is staggering.
Neville Devete on the line from his home in North Queensland, and he was speaking there to reporter Liam Fox. Three decades after the Panguna mine on Bougainville was shut down in the midst of a civil war, a major environmental assessment has begun with the aim of reopening the facility. As our Papua New Guinea correspondent Tim Swanston reports, the mine was at the centre of a decades-long armed conflict between rebels and the PNG security forces, and it has lain dormant ever since.
Under the hot sun, men, women and children are digging for gold deep in the pit at Panguna, which was once one of the largest copper and gold mines in the world. This alluvial mining is risky work, but many feel they don't have any other options.
Most of our land has been destroyed that we could plant cocoa to get an income. So that's why we have some of our people paying for gold.
That's Bernadine Kira, a community representative.
Life has changed a lot. People are really struggling now to find money to pay for school fees, to pay for medical expenses, even to build good houses.
The mine closed in 1989 when local anger about the environmental impact and the small amounts of money being paid to landowners sparked an insurgency leading to thousands of deaths. The mine's operator, Bougainville Copper Limited, which was majority owned by Rio Tinto, hastily closed the facility and it's since fallen into ruin. Millions of tonnes of mine waste, or tailings, is washed into rivers and creeks, contaminating once clean water. Villager Veni Neo tries to collect rainwater for his supplies.
When the mine was operating, the Jabba River was destroyed, including all the smaller streams. When we see that it is about to rain, we put out our things to collect rainwater. But if we are late, there will be no water.
Bernadine Kira says most people don't have access to clean drinking water.
Because all our sources where we used to get clean drinking water, it's been polluted by the mine, by the tailings.
For the first time, the widespread environmental damage is being independently assessed by a team of scientists. It's been mostly funded by Rio Tinto in response to a complaint filed by the Human Rights Law Centre on behalf of landowners alleging serious environmental and human rights impacts. Local MP and complainant Theonila Matbob wants the company to fund remediation.
They have to come out publicly, even if they're not going to go to the details, if they can say, yes, after the assessment, we are committed to finding solution and then doing something about the findings of the assessment. There's none as yet.
In a statement, Rio Tinto says the legacy impact assessment is the first key step to identifying impacts and discussing next steps with all parties. In 2016, the company transferred its shareholding to the PNG and autonomous Bougainville governments, and plans to reopen it have stalled. Robin Wilson is Bougainville's minerals minister.
If the mine opens, the mine is expected to operate for 28 years. And it's expected to make returns in excess of $58 billion. So that's a lot of money there.
But for now, the future of the mine isn't clear.
That was PNG correspondent Tim Swanston reporting. And now it's time to find out the big stories that made headlines across the Pacific this week. And to do that, we're joined by Pacific Beat presenter Talia Olatia. Hi, Talia. Let's start in Papua New Guinea, which saw a fiery parliament session this week. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. The furor surrounding PNG's former foreign minister, Justin Tuchenko, continued when he sought to make an official apology and personally explain his comments when he called critics of his daughter primitive animals. Now, opposition MP Belden Nama was not having it, interrupting Mr. Tuchenko and strongly objecting to him addressing the House.
He made a statement to our international media. He should not be allowed to make a statement today. He should resign in disgrace and get out of this parliament.
But as Mr. Tuchenko is still the representative for Moresby South, the Speaker allowed it, which then saw Mr. Nama and a handful of MPs walk out during his address. Mr. Tuchenko went on to apologise, saying his comments were, quote, misinterpreted. Of course, you'll remember Mr. Tuchenko made the comments to the ABC while defending his daughter Savannah from furious online backlash to a TikTok video that she posted last month while part of the PNG's official delegation to the coronation of King Charles III. arrested. And, you know, all of this drama has kind of distracted from the original financial concerns around the 30-member delegation that PNG sent to the King's coronation, which we heard in Parliament is still being investigated.
Yes, indeed. I'm very curious to know the outcome of this investigation. But Talia, now let's go to some geopolitical news from the region, because security deals seem to have been the flavour of the week, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really right. Vanuatu's Prime Minister Ismail Kausikau says he expects that a security agreement with Australia will go to his country's parliament for ratification by the end of this year.
It's at the National Security Council at the moment. It's going through the text. It will go towards the Council of Ministers and it will be presented for ratification before the end of this year in parliament.
Now, the pact was inked during a visit by Australia's foreign minister last year, but members of Vanuatu's government and opposition as well have expressed concerns about that deal, and they say that it could potentially encroach on the country's sovereignty. Vanuatu, as we know, fiercely independent. And these are concerns that are also shared by Papua New Guinea, who are also delaying a proposed security deal with Australia. PNG's Prime Minister James Marape has said the treaty is a work in progress. Meanwhile, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka says their police deal with China is under review as the government is considering even possibly cancelling it. He made these comments this week during a state visit to Aotearoa, where his government and New Zealand held talks regarding a defence agreement, which is expected to be finalised next week.
Now, Talia, politics aside, it was also a big week of Pacific sport. What happened?
Yeah, it was a big week, and that big week looks to continue as well. Samoa's Manasina claimed the Oceania Women's Rugby Championships against the Fijiana with a nail-biting penalty kick on the final buzzer. In soccer news, Vanuatu got behind its captain, Brian Kautek, who helped the Central Coast Mariners take home the A-League Grand Final, and Vanuatu certainly went off with that news. In rugby, the Fiji and Drua beat the Reds at home to secure their spot in the Super Rugby Pacific playoffs for the first time. They'll meet the reigning champs, the Crusaders, in Christchurch this weekend for a do-or-die match. And going back to football, New Caledonia's Academy Feminine looked to be the favourites at the inaugural OFC Women Champions League tournament. But should they lose this weekend and PNG's Hikari defeat Fiji's Lambassa in the final match of the tournament, then the PNG team could take home the trophy on a goal difference. So lots of sporting news expected for this weekend as well.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Talia. And now to Vanuatu, where the government is working to register tens of thousands of its citizens to a new cash transfer program that will allow people to receive and spend digital money. It will use blockchain technology to send the payments and aims to support families in the wake of natural disasters like cyclones or floods. But the program is new, and there are some concerns whether every citizen will be able to access the phone-based system. In a busy church on the island of Ambrim, people aren't queuing up to hear the latest sermon. Instead, the pews are filled with people updating their personal details on a national database. Government workers from Vanuatu's capital have travelled to the island to register every household. They'll be part of an ambitious project to send aid directly to families in the wake of disasters.
They want to send some money to all the people, but before they do that, they must verify our names.
Jossie Obed owns a guest house in the north of Ambrim. Now that his family have lodged their names in the national database, he's looking forward to receiving government payments.
It's good. It's much better than the dry rations we usually get. There are many islands that need the dry rations, things like rice or tinned fish, but that's because they need help quickly. But some of us that don't need dry rations, they're going to give us cash payments instead.
But the cash payments won't be sent by a bank or by wire transfer. Instead, Vanuatu is experimenting with using an internet-based app built on blockchain technology to send digital currency directly to citizens. Recipients can then use this digital money in participating stores that are also signed up to the cash transfer system. Jossie doesn't completely understand how it will work.
I don't know how the money will get to us. They told us we won't be handling it like cash, but it somehow gets to us. I don't really know how to explain it, but I know it'll use our phones.
Ambram is one of the early islands to be signed up to the scheme, which will then roll out across the nation. Vanuatu's Finance Minister, John Salong, who is heading the project, says the cash transfers will be linked to the national ID of the heads of each household.
So it's going to be using internet to be able to do vendor businesses. So it's going to go from the government to the heads of the households and linked to the national IDs and the heads of households. Once they're registered with the app, they will be given an 8-digit PIN code, and it's using blockchain technology. And so basically, it's secure. And once digital funds have been transmitted to the household heads, they will then be able to use their national IDs to interact with vendors, and vendors will need to, of course, have online access. Vendors will need to have a smartphone.
The household heads will be female, Mr. Salong says, and the aim of the program is to support the country when hit by disaster.
Cash transfer will be part of early recovery intervention on the part of the government. So it means that we need to register 66,000 households and in a very short period of time. Clarify that their data is valid with the verification of the CRIM database, and then we will be able to use their national IDs to send them digital money.
The app is still being developed by Vanuatu's postal service, but Mr. Salong says it will be ready by the end of July. It's an ambitious time frame, and there are already hurdles to overcome. The people of Lelepa Island were the first to be entered into the national database to receive payments, but that campaign faced some technical issues.
From there, we learned a few things, that we need to have fast internet and that we need to be interacting with a good database.
And then there's the issue of cyber security, particularly in light of a massive cyber attack that brought Vanuatu's government to its knees last year. Minister Salong says that's why the government is using blockchain to deliver the payments.
I've been told that's more secure.
Blockchain aside, there is mounting research that direct payments can efficiently and effectively help vulnerable families. Diana Contreras-Suarez from the Melbourne Institute for Economic and Social Research says these programs have been in place for decades in some countries which give money directly to its poorest citizens.
This in contrast to other ways of distributing benefits, like, for example, food or vouchers or in-kind transfers. The problem with that, or the limitation that that requires, is that it requires a lot of logistic and infrastructure built around how to deliver these type of programs. While with cash, you just need to make a transfer or find a way of delivering the cash, and that's it.
But despite these positive findings, cash transfers remain fairly new to aid work and have barely been used after disasters.
In terms of humanitarian aid, using cash transfers is very controversial, and it hasn't been used, so there is not too much research about.
For that reason, Diana says researchers would be watching Vanuatu's cash transfer program very closely. But she does foresee some challenges, particularly in the use of blockchain technology and smartphones to deliver the money.
I think the main concern that comes to my mind is, like, how do you make sure that the money gets to the people that it's intending to be reached? So if it's using, for example, the app, you need to make sure that everyone has a phone. And everyone has the app, and everyone has the knowledge of the app. Also, for example, women or people in rural populations, they also have lower rates of mobile ownership. So if those are the areas that are more likely to be affected by those crises that the government wants to support, then they are going to have problems again reaching the population that they intend to.
The Vanuatu government is aiming to register 66,000 households in the country and begin the first payments using the app next month. And finally, Tonga is set to become the first Pacific Islands country to experiment with wave technology when work commences on a new power wave park later this year. If all goes to plan, it could halve Tonga's energy needs, but there are challenges to get the cutting-edge technology up and running, as Kyle Evans reports.
People across the world are feeling the pinch of rising power prices, but in Tonga, it's particularly bad.
I think it's way too high. Very high in comparison with current salary ranges here in Tonga at the moment.
Mapata Malolo is a Tongan resident and also used to help manage infrastructure and energy programs while at the Australian High Commission. He says the extreme power costs are pushing people to take steps to control their usage.
And we can see the ripple effects of the hikes in the electricity prices. We have witnessed this since the hikes in the electricity bills last year. I'm sure you're aware of the mass complaints from customers in mid last year. And there is a huge impact on the cost of living here in Tonga.
And though some families are turning to solar panels to help them get through, Mr. Tamalolo says electricity prices have only gotten higher.
I believe we do not have the right configuration and also the exact setup for the renewable energy system. And from my previous career, I was able to witness that these solar panels and having this run on grid is actually more expensive than running off diesel, which was quite unexpected.
Now the Kingdom of Tonga has come up with a new plan. The government has signed a memorandum of understanding with an Irish-based wave energy firm called Seabased. They plan to develop a 10-megawatt wave power park off the coast of Tongatapu. It will capture energy from waves and turn it into electricity.
There's an operation in WA called Carnegie Wave Energy. They use a similar system to the one that's proposed by Seabased in Tonga. And so that's one I'm actually very familiar with.
Ray Wills is the managing director of business advisory firm FutureSmart and chairs a number of green technology companies.
A whole range of different ways to collect it. The one in Tonga is the one that is going to be a point source absorber, and it will move up and down as the wave passes over top. Inside it is just a generator that will spin and create electricity. They have a good advantage because they're fairly low disturbance. They sit under the water, so they're protected from a rougher ocean. And there's a string of other things. It's very minimal impact environmentally. And in fact, some would argue it can enhance the environment around because it actually provides more places to live. These attenuators can be populated, that things can grow on them. And if we can make it work commercially, then it's a very reliable, cheap energy source.
The project will be delivered in two phases. The first will be a 2-megawatt park, which will generate enough power for close to 3,000 homes. Once the entire 10-megawatt project is complete, it's expected to provide half of Tonga's energy and cut emissions by 20%. But Professor Will says the technology is far from perfect.
It's largely to do with the fact that living in the ocean's a fairly harsh environment for a piece of metal. And so you've got to be able to anchor it, you've got to be able to protect it from corrosion, you've got to be able to ensure that it's going to survive big storms as they come through. And all of those things, if they don't do those things, then you've got to repair and maintain. And so, therefore, it adds cost to the generation. All that cost belongs in the project. And the project then needs to make money to stay profitable, to keep working. So that's really the challenge. And really coming up with what is the ideal design, the one that actually is best performing, is going to be the cheapest.
Ray says the biggest challenge is ensuring the project remains efficient early on.
The maintenance is, it shouldn't be all that complicated. Our local population in Tonga should be able to be trained up easily to be the service agents for the project. That's only particularly useful if the project is large enough. If it's too small and it's a part-time job, it might not be something that keeps the skill set in place because you may go to another job. Whereas if it's a sizable project that therefore needs a bit of manpower, then you will be able to actually maintain a stable workforce around it. This is the usual problems of commerciality, is the problems of ensuring you've got sufficient scale. to actually make it worth doing the exercise.
Tonga plans to have the entire wave technology project completed by 2025.
Kyle Evans with that report, and the ABC has reached out to the Tongan government for that story. We are yet to receive a response. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.